The Faces of Contemporary Islam, Fresh Perspectives on Theory, Practice, and Foreign Policy, a Women's Foreign Policy Group Conference in Washington, D.C., featuring Carnegie Scholars. This November 18, 2008 podcast is a production of the Women's Foreign Policy Group with funding from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. The following panel, The Compatibility of Islam and Democracy, features Asma Afsaruddin, a professor at the University of Notre Dame and a 2005 Carnegie Scholar. Elizabeth Thompson, a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and a 2005 Carnegie Scholar. And Alora Shihabuddin, a professor at Rice University and a 2006 Carnegie Scholar. Gail Lefwich-Kitch, the vice chair of the Women's Foreign Policy Group, moderates.
Now we have, I think, a wonderful panel to follow on those very thought-provoking remarks, and in particular, thinking about the compatibility of Islam and democracy. And, of course, we had some allusions to that, which I think we can explore in greater detail with through this panel. And I think
all of us, when we think, well, I know I shouldn't say all of us, I'm presuming, but I know certainly I, and I suspect numbers of you, and certainly I think the American public more generally, really do have this very interesting sort of challenge when we think of Islam and democracy, and how do those words reconcile, and what do those terms really mean? And I think we've got some folks here who can really help us think through what the implications of those are. Our first speaker, Asma Afsaruddin, who was with the University of Notre Dame, was a 2005 Carnegie Scholar. She's been someone who's been a part of this for a while now. Her work is focused on striving in the path of God, discursive traditions on jihad, and the cult of martyrdom. And she'll be speaking with us first. So.
Thank you very much. And thanks to the entire crew at Women's Foreign Policy Group, particularly Patricia Ellis and Pat Rosenfeld, also at the Carnegie program, to put this panel together and this whole conference together. I think it's a wonderful idea to bring these various voices and perspectives in one panel. In January 2008, when the president of Turkey, Abdullah Gül, visited the White House, President George Bush offered these exuberant words of welcome. Turkey, he said, sets a fantastic example for nations around the world to see where it's possible to have a democracy coexist with a great religion like Islam, end of quote. It was appropriate, after all, for Bush to mention religion in the same breath as democracy when hosting a head of state who had just set an important political precedent in the Islamic world. Abdullah Gül's election provided a glistening example of the compatibility of Islam and democracy, if I may be permitted to use these terms as they usually are in a reified sense. A number of people have begun terming this democratic phenomenon occurring in Muslim-majority societies as Muslim or Islamic democracy along the lines of Christian democracy in Europe. While some rather vocal types have labeled Islamic democracy as an oxymoron, others have pointed out that the compatibility of Christianity with democracy was similarly questioned not too long ago and not deemed to be convincing until about perhaps the middle of the 20th century. There are other similarities. The Islamic religious and political tradition, like the Christian one, can draw on certain internal resources to lay a theoretical ground for the promotion of what constitutes democratic ideals today. Three concepts, which I'm going to call the three C's, are regarded by Muslim thinkers in general as the building blocks of a democratic paradigm within the Islamic milieu. These three C's are consultation, consent, and consensus. Very quickly, let me indicate why they are regarded as the basic building blocks of Muslim democratic polities. First, consultation. This corresponds to the Arabic word shura. Shura is a Quranic concept and thus sanctified by revelation and rooted in the practice of the Prophet Muhammad. Two Quranic verses, chapter 3, verses 158 through 59, and chapter 42, verse 38, advocate consultative decision-making and are frequently quoted in this context. Shura, and the principle of accountability it embodies, has in fact been the clarion call of many Muslims railing against despotic government throughout the pre-modern and modern periods. Liberal and modernist Muslims in particular insist that a representative and accountable government, which upholds justice and equitable treatment for all its citizens, is the only kind permissible within Islam, regardless of what its actual structure and mode may be. Secondly, the Arabic word bay'ah corresponds to consent, also contract, introducing yet another C, also translated as allegiance. It is well known that newly converted Muslims, male and female, personally came to the Prophet and gave him their bay'ah, their allegiance or their consent, which signaled their inclusion in the Islamic community. In the post-prophetic period, this remained a standard practice which served to recognize the importance of the people's explicit or tacit consent to being governed by specific individuals. The practice of bay'ah, or allegiance, continued at least nominally, even when dynastic rule became the norm. Thirdly, ijma' is the Arabic word for consensus. Consensus is, ideally speaking, the logical result of the consultative process and collective decision-making. In addition to consultation and consent, liberal and modernist Muslims underscore the concept of consensus to point to what they believe is the inherently democratic impulse within Islam. Ijma' is not a Quranic term, but its normativeness is established through the practices of the earliest Muslims. Modernists thus refer to the process of selection of the caliphs, the early leaders from the early period, which depended on popular ratification to establish its legitimacy. The manner of election of these early leaders, they affirm, points to the importance of building a broad base of consensus to legitimize key political decisions in particular. Now, to fast forward to the contemporary period, a number of significant polls and surveys conducted recently have categorically established that a majority of Muslim populations want democratic governments and respect for religious values at the same time. This is to affirm something that Professor Esposito already stressed in his talk. The most comprehensive survey to date, as we've already heard, has been conducted by the Gallup organization in more than 35 nations with a majority or significant Muslim populations over a period of 6 years ending in 2007. This is such a broad-ranging comprehensive survey that it is safe to derive certain conclusions based on the results of it. And basically, the results of the survey affirms what many of us had been stating all along, that Muslims in a wide cross-section of the Islamic world desire democratic reform in their countries. The survey also establishes that most Muslims want to be assured that democracy, as is usually defined, in no way threatens the religious values and freedoms. Again, to reiterate what Professor Esposito said about the views of most Muslims that the Sharia and or practice of democracy are not incompatible. This is a legitimate concern on the part of Muslims and needs to be addressed head on, especially to pull the rug out from under various anti-democratic elements. There are two persistent beliefs, perhaps even myths, which sometimes renders the selling of liberal democracy that much harder. One belief is that democracy is inevitably predicated on secularism, and secularism, many aver, means evacuating religion from the public sphere and banishing it to the private one. The second belief, or myth, if you like, is that in Islam, religion and politics are forever joined at the hip, and never can the two be separated for fear of violating a presumed divine commandment. Both beliefs or assumptions deserve revisiting and re-examination. The first assumption proceeds out of a kind of democratic fundamentalism, if I may call it that, or democratic absolutism, which holds that there is one recipe for establishing democracy, and any system that falls short of total conformity with its prescriptions, including secularism, cannot qualify as a fully functioning democracy. This dogmatic view fails to take into account the different inflections of democracy in different parts of the world, with varying degrees of secularism. It also ignores the resurgence of religious values in democratic America, for example, and the process of negotiation that this has entailed between religious and secular values. For a democracy to live up to its name, it has to be accommodating of religious values and sentiment if this is reflective of the popular will. As Abdul Karim Sarush has perceptively remarked, and I quote, in a religious society, any purely secular government would be undemocratic, end of quote. The second assumption is based on an ahistorical reading of the growth of Islamic political thought and completely overlooks the lack of evidence in the early sources for a notion of sacred or sacralized politics in the formative years of the Islamic polity. Rather, political governance was deemed necessary for the utilitarian purpose of containing chaos in the temporal realm and maintaining order in society, rather than as the realization of some religious imperative. No particular system or mode of government was understood to be divinely mandated in order to attain these utilitarian objectives. This, however, did not mean that religious and moral values and religiosity had no place in the public sphere. To the contrary, politics as part of the public sphere is also subject to broad, and one may argue, universal moral guidelines, and any system of government that best reflects the Quranic prescription of consultative and collective decision-making could be deemed acceptable. It is this kind of political culture that has remained a desideratum in most Muslim-majority societies. Religion and morality are meant to be the allies and reinforcers of consultative, accountable forms of government. This pairing has its parallel in Western political theory as well, starting in the period of classical Athenian democracy. How each, religion and politics, should be calibrated to fulfill the requirements of the other and to maintain a positive symbiotic relationship is open to collective human deliberation and negotiation in variegated times and places. This is an important manifestation, after all, of what we now deem to be the democratic process. Thank you.
We'll hear from all three speakers, just so people know what we're going to be doing, and then I'm going to invite them to sort of respond to each other's remarks, and then I'll open it up for questions. And now our second speaker is Elizabeth Thompson. She's at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, was a 2005 Carnegie Scholar, and her work is Seeking Justice in the Modern Middle East.
Thank you. Good morning, and thank you for having me here. I didn't travel far. I'm lucky to be here in Washington, D.C., but I'm with some children who inevitably give me colds at the most inopportune times, so I hope you'll be able to understand me, and I'll drink lots of water. Okay, I am a historian of the late colonial period. What interests me about this, these are the last decades of colonialism, particularly in the Middle East and in the Arab world, and I'm particularly interested in the period of the 20th century when democratic movements mobilized in a situation of foreign occupation and by foreign occupiers in particular, who were there and placed there after World War I with the intent of teaching Arabs to govern themselves and teaching them democratic values. All right. I'll come back to that, and for those of you who don't see the immediate relevance of those themes to our current situation today, I'll draw them out. But what I'd like to do is move to the story of Arab democracy nearly 100 years ago. We talk about creating Arab democracy, and there it was. It's a story much neglected in today's policy debates. It's a story about the convening of a constitutional assembly, debates over more than 100 articles of that constitution, the rise of an opposition party against the king's elitist party that succeeded in wrenching from the executive greater powers for the legislature and enshrining those in the Constitution. Okay, in a constitution that probably was more democratic than any constitution to that point. This is the year 1920 and since. It is an extraordinary story that I think contributes to efforts by scholars like Asma Svardin to boil down the basic principles, democratic principles within Islam, but it is one that is instructive because it is in the almost living memory of many Arabs today. These would have been great-grandfathers, I imagine, for those of older people today. Certainly, in living in Syria, it was a living memory because it was, in fact, there in the city of Damascus in 1920 that this Constitutional Congress took place. One moment. A few details. One star of the show, the king involved, was King Faisal. If you saw the movie Lawrence of Arabia, that was Alec Guinness. Except that I show that movie to my students at the University of Virginia still. It's a fine movie, but their test is always, what's wrong with the last scene? All right. The last scene presupposes that there were no people in Damascus that knew how to run the city and that it was overrun by tribal Bedouin who could not remember. There's the funny scene of Omar Sharif standing on the desk and yelling, and they're fighting over the waterworks, I believe. Or no, a generator. Does anybody know how to get the electrical generator running? In fact, what happened in Damascus after that point was this extraordinary story of Arabs coming together. There were Arabs from Lebanon, from Palestine, from what would become Transjordan, there were some from Egypt, and there were some from Iraq, as well as Syria, who gathered there, more than 100 of them. And Faisal called together the Constitutional Congress in the spirit of the moment. This was the post-war era when, like Obama today, Woodrow Wilson was the rock star of his age. When he arrived in Paris in January 1919, his face was plastered over newspapers all around the world, and especially in the Arab world. They had been publishing his speeches about this being a war for democracy and the right of even small nations to govern themselves in their newspapers, okay, as long as they were free. Those Arab societies that had recently come out from under military rule by the Ottomans at the end of the war got the news a little bit later. But nonetheless, in Syria, they rallied to the cause. The second star of the show was the president elected of the Constitutional Congress. His name was Rashid Ridda. He was the most famous Islamic reformer of the day. Let me repeat it. The man who oversaw the drawing up of the most democratic constitution in the Arab world was himself an Islamic reformer. He wore a turban. He published the most read journal, Al-Manar, on reforming and modernizing Islam for the modern age. He was well versed in the scriptures and the sources on the functioning of Arab government and Islamic government under the Prophet and his successors in the 7th century. And he proclaimed what you and I would call essentially a pretty average looking but fairly liberal constitutional monarchy set up in 1920 Damascus as an Islamic form of government. And Muslims would be proud of it, and certainly there were sheikhs, religious scholars in that Congress and outside who approved of it. Okay. Another interesting detail about that Congress was that the issue of women's suffrage came up. Women had been mobilized during World War I, building schools, providing soup kitchens, and trying to rebuild a society devastated by the war. Faisal had organized them to help promote his message of social progress and rebuilding from the war. But they defied Faisal, just as the opposition party did. And they rode a train. There's famous the story of them riding a train from Beirut to Damascus in June 1920 to present their petition asking for the right to vote in that constitution. There was a wonderful debate that ensued in June 1920 about women's right to vote. Men stood up from Palestine and Lebanon and Iraq and said women should have the right to vote. They were consulted by the prophet, and they are citizens of our country. Others stood up and said, no, no, no. Heaven forbid if we let women vote and make decisions like that on their own, they won't obey their husbands anymore. Outside of the Congress, a mob, called mob by those inside, formed and rallied against the question of women's suffrage. And here brings me, I come to the point of interest today in thinking about how one goes about promoting democracy, in particular women's rights, in the Middle East. I look at this moment as an important precedent from which we can draw lessons and which we must necessarily pay attention to if we seek to intervene in these issues, because what happens here? Rashid Rida came to the front of the Constitutional Congress as president and gave the last word on the debate. He said, my friends, we have people outside, you know, they're kind of the popular groups rallied by the opposition party, which I remind you was more democratic than Faisal's elitist party. They were much more populist. They did not want Faisal to have pure, you know, absolute power as the monarch, but they were also very religious. They did it on religious grounds. And they were mobilizing a discourse of Islam. They were playing along with this Congress, but this was a boundary and a contentious point. All of us who know our own history of constitutional law and the debates over who would be included as a citizen and who not would sympathize here. But he said, we cannot afford to vote on this today. All right. Why? Because the French have amassed their troops across the border in Lebanon, and they are ready to occupy Damascus. We must show the world that we are a functioning democratic government so that the French would not dare invade us. This is the world. He lived in the world of Woodrow Wilson. He appealed to world opinion, as Wilson did, to defend and uphold against all hope that this Arab kingdom in Syria would remain independent. And so the vote for women's suffrage was set aside, and the Constitution was adopted with male universal suffrage only. The lesson and of interest here today, I think, is this, that it was precisely at that moment and in the memory of women and men who had supported the cause, the threat of foreign occupation that had undermined their cause. Men were already worried about their authority at home, and here, you know, whether if women went out to vote, would they obey their husbands? And now they had to worry that they would not even be able to rule themselves, that they would not be given the dignity proclaimed by Wilson to of self-determination. What set in motion in July 1920, as the French troops came in and occupied Damascus and sent Faisal fleeing, was a profound change in the political culture of the Arab world. All right. The Congress in 1920 had built on earlier constitutional movements, most notably one in Egypt in 1882, and one led by the Ottoman Turks with Arabs cooperating in 1908. But after this moment, Rashid Rida himself turned against the West, defined Islamic government as something opposed to Western liberalism, as something different from inequality, and led and inspired a new political movement led by, back in Egypt. He too had to flee Syria. He went back to Egypt where he was publishing his magazine and inspired Hassan al-Banna and the Muslim Brotherhood to advocate a model of justice, a model of just Islamic government that would be based on a basis different from the West. And here I have to qualify something before you jump to any conclusions, right? Because, sorry about the voice, while the basic principles would be different, and the political strategy here is clear to the historian, it means that the West has nothing to teach us. We don't have to be taught democracy. We have our own principles. And indeed, if you look at Banna's vision, it is constitutional. All right, he too emphasized popular sovereignty as Islamic and the need for the ruler to consult. All right, and the rule of law He did not hold the reified, rigid view of Islamic law that is now prevalent in the Middle East. This is a consequence of this break and this political moment. All right? He actually held a fairly flexible view. If you read his readings, as I have painfully done so, he was an ornate, wonderful writer. But boy, do I wish he wrote in simple newspaper Arabic. Okay. But in the end, then, came the divide between Islam and the West and the idea that somehow Islam and democracy were two separate things. This is the legacy of the occupation of Syria in 1920. It is a memory held by them Arabs today, told to them by their grandparents, of democracy and rights stolen. A story of justice interrupted, which is the title of an article that I'm writing on this very topic. It is relevant today because the story also tells us two things, that Arabs do have a culture that is open to democracy. There's not a problem with their culture. Right? There is a problem with the political history that has mobilized anti-democratic elements. Every society has anti-democratic elements in them, even our own, as we well know. And that it was, in fact, in their memory, foreign occupation that mobilized and strengthened the most anti-democratic elements in their societies. I don't care if it's the United States, it's the French, the British, any foreign power who moves into a foreign country must rule through intermediaries. They do not go to the local Communist Party and women's movement as their intermediaries. They go to landowners, tribal chiefs, and religious authorities, people who can control the population, who look stable. That is what the French did. That is what we have done in Afghanistan and Iraq. It is not an evil thing to do. It is a necessary thing to do when you are a foreign occupier. But it should give us pause when we start conceptualizing a program and a policy that envisions building democratic politics under the conditions of occupation. All right? Just in a practical sense, it doesn't work. You, as the foreign occupier, must rule through anti-democratic elements. But in a cultural and more moral and a practical sense as well, particularly in the Arab world, it mobilizes those memories of 1920 and other occupations. It was laughable to Arabs to hear Americans, you know, particularly I remember the speech of George Bush proclaiming the war on terrorism, and there was Tony Blair sitting right in front and center, and Arabs who had been ruled by the British in the 1920s and 30s and 40s knew the British did not bring democracy, and that they could not, and that we would not. But it is also instructive, and I'll end with this note, that Arabs did then and do remember Woodrow Wilson, and they do remember that there was another way of promoting and giving countries space internationally, the sovereignty and security from the outside while respecting their own right to self-determination and to their own democracy. Thank you very much.
Very interesting. And our third speaker, Alora Shahabedin, is with Rice University. She's a 2006 Carnegie Scholar, Women at the Muslim Center, Islamic Ideals and Democratic Exigencies, and the Moderate Muslim, I gather, also.
Right. So, thank you. Thank you, again, just to repeat what Asma said, for organizing this wonderful event. I'd like to begin with an excerpt from a 2004 article in Newsweek. For more than 30 years, much of the Muslim world has been sliding backward, away from modernity. Some voices of reason, however, have to stand up and say, enough, there is a modern world and Muslims should be part of it. Well, at long last, that chorus is growing among Muslims. And if you listen to the most strident voices, I'm still quoting, damned if they don't sound like an all-woman band. They're way out there on the edge of the faith. Their message and their lifestyles are so far from the torpid Muslim mainstream, they're almost in the desert, end quote. The moderate Muslim is almost a Western invention, and since 9/11, she has been eagerly sought out as an ally in various causes and adventures. As this quotation shows, the moderate, good Muslims most celebrated in the West today also happen to be female. I take that back. They are female precisely because certain Western political entities and cultural outlets insists that Muslim women are severely and uniquely oppressed, even in the torpid Muslim mainstream, and need to be saved. Perhaps aware of the Ritz scholarship criticizing the long tradition of colonial feminism, journalists, scholars, and bloggers of a certain type are now relieved to have found women who are Muslim, ex-Muslim, or non-Muslim, but from the Muslim world, to further their missions to bring democracy and women's rights into those benighted countries. What is striking about the recent refrains about moderate Muslims and calls for an Islamic reformation is their blatant disregard for history and politics. They assume that Islam must follow a path similar to Western Christianity and that modernity and freedom must be understood the same way by everyone everywhere. They also ignore the well-documented historical precedents of such calls to save Muslim women. Laila Boulougoud has written extensively on this, and I know we'll hear more later. While there are clear parallels in the use of Muslim women's plights as a justification for the colonial enterprise of the 19th century and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan today, there are, of course, also significant differences between the two situations. Not only are there differences in the formal structures of the former British and French empires and American empire today, but the very nature of the relationship between the West and the Muslim world has changed, and today is mediated through oil, wars, and very crucially, the presence of Israel. Moreover, Muslims, whether converts or immigrants, are now present in the West in numbers that could not have been foreseen at the height of colonialism. And it is from this population that the most vehement and best publicized attacks against the Islamic oppression of women have been launched, with grave implications for Muslim women as well as for scholarly research about them. Here I have in mind best-selling authors and speakers like Irshad Manji and Ayan Hirsi Ali, but also Noni Darwish, Brigitte Gabriel, and Wafa Sultan. In a 2007 report titled Building Moderate Muslim Networks, the RAND Corporation argues that it is incumbent upon the United States to help develop and support networks of moderate Muslims in order to fight the, I quote, ideologically driven global jihadist movement, end quote, just as the U.S. fought the spread of communism during the Cold War by supporting democratic networks and institutions in the Soviet bloc. One of the first steps in this process, the report points out, is to separate true moderates from those who may appear to be moderate. While the report formally identifies support for democracy, pluralism, and gender equality as the mark of true moderate Muslims, one finds time and again that support for neoliberal and neoconservative agendas are taken to be far more reliable indicators of one's moderation. Thus, long-standing local efforts to confront injustice are studiously ignored or hastily dismissed when these groups or individuals don't quite fit the mold of the moderate. For instance, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, RAWA, merits no mention at all in Irshad Manji's lengthy discussion of the Taliban in her best-selling book. RAWA, as it turns out, and as you may know, had been openly critical of the U.S. plans to bomb Afghanistan, predicting correctly that Afghani women's suffering would only increase. To further appreciate why these particular women authors are so celebrated, it's also worth turning our attention briefly to another female ex-Muslim critic, one who often appears on the same lists as Manji and Hirsi Ali, but significantly not always. The Bangladeshi writer Taslima Nasreen, quickly dubbed the female Rushdie by NPR, rose to international fame a full decade before the others. In 1993, long before 9/11 and the current moment of fascination with Islam. I believe she has distinguished herself as the wrong kind of Muslim dissident because she has been critical of all religion, as well as of the recent US-led wars, and because she has not identified Christianity or Judaism as better for women and the West or Israel as havens of gender equality. By contrast, as though working from the same manual, the popular authors I mentioned earlier, Manji, Hirsi Ali, etc., whose memoirs have all appeared in the past 5 years, all attack the treatment of women in Islamic countries, they celebrate gender equality in Israel and the West, and generally ignore all recent serious scholarship on these subjects. What is most pernicious, of course, is that it is their books, rather than the painstaking labors of scholars, that is eagerly consumed by the media and the public, reinforcing misconceptions and lending support to destructive policies. These personal stories are seen as representative of all Muslims and Arabs. These individuals are taken to be exemplary victims of an Islam that is opposed to women and feminism. They are then feted as authorities on Islam, on Muslim women, and feminism at all times and in all places. This failure on the part of these women, as well as their audience, to understand the internal complexity of these categories has profound political consequences. A lack of attention to context and history leaves us with unhelpful caricatures that simply perpetuate Islamophobia and promote complacency about tolerance within the West. My point is not that there is no such thing as moderation in Islam or among Muslims, and certainly not in the sense proposed by those who would have us believe that all Muslims harbor a latent hostility to the West and democratic liberal modernity. Rather, I'm emphasizing the need to contextualize Islam and, of course, Muslims, Muslim individuals, men and women, groups, parties, states, and ideologies. However, in moving beyond dichotomies like radical and moderate, we should be prepared to find out that while Islam and democracy may be quite compatible, these Democrats hold views on women, Israel, and U.S. foreign policy that confound us. In reality, of course, and now we have the survey data to prove this, large numbers of Muslim men and women throughout the world are struggling for change. Their diagnosis of the problem, however, is different. For them, it is not Islam that is the problem, and thus changing or doing away with Islam is not the solution. Muslim women are certainly fighting male-biased interpretations of the Quran, but they are also protesting unjust secular laws. They're also protesting the unequal fruits of economic globalization and neoliberal policies, oppressive states that may well be allied with the US, and in some instances, American presence itself. No doubt they also want democracy, but real democracy, not one where all Western aid is suspended when the results are displeasing, as in the case of Hamas a few years ago. Also high on the list is likely to be electricity, running water, and security, scarce commodities in places like Iraq and Gaza. Women are engaging in these struggles both through secular organizations and the Islamist movements I've been studying as part of my Carnegie research. These women, as must be clear, do not neatly fit the image of moderate Muslim women created by think tanks, the media, and sections of the public, fabricated indeed in direct opposition to the figure of the terrorist or fundamentalist. Since the latter is generally assumed to be seen to be a bearded man who is religious and lives in the past and in caves also, and hates America, Israel, and their culture and policies, the moderate Muslim must be a woman who is not visibly religious, but rather modern and Western, i.e. she doesn't veil, thinks critically about Islamic texts and traditions, or better still, has renounced Islam and loves America, Israel, and their culture and policies. These best-selling memoirs do make for good reading. What is forgotten is that they're fascinating precisely because they are unusual, dramatic experiences. After all, who really wants to read, let alone pay money for a book, about an ordinary, generally or happy Muslim childhood? Yet their stories are taken to be emblematic of the authentic female Muslim experience, both in terms of the basis for their suffering, Islam, and the source of their hope and renewal, the West, and in some cases, Israel. Those who support them can simply point to them in response to charges that the East has not been allowed to represent itself, that the subaltern has not been permitted to speak. Yet in the end, the only acceptable feminist voice becomes one that is anti-Islamic, pro-war on terror, pro-West, and pro-Israel. That emerges as the true Muslim, moderate Muslim voice in the US media and government. Sorry, that emerges as the true moderate Muslim voice in the US media and That emerges as the true Muslim modern Muslim voice that the US media and government seek out so urgently. This is dangerous, not because a few women are achieving fame and fortune, but because it diverts attention from the wide variety of very real problems facing women in the Muslim world as elsewhere, and vital resources from projects that could help them. And because it suppresses critics of government policy toward the Arab and Muslim worlds by dismissing them as anti-Semitic and Islamofascist. Surely, in this global climate, it is not immoderate to point out that what is needed is not an Islamic reformation led by those who support the wealthy and well-armed. What this era demands is attention to history and politics, and a feminism that is anti-racist and critical of unjust policies everywhere, in the West as well as in the Muslim world. Thank you.
This has been a production of the Women's Foreign Policy Group with funding from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For more information about this and other Women's Foreign Policy Group events, please visit www.wfpg.org.